for the conference. I hope those of you who didn't get books will be interested enough in this topic that you'll find copies on your own. But I want you to be able to hear the voices behind the words in the book. I think that's important. And it's part of what I hope makes this book different and makes it special. The project itself was, the oral history project was sponsored by the National Park Service. Congress passed legislation that created the Tuskegee Airmen National Historic Site in Tuskegee, Alabama, and President Clinton signed it into law in 1998. And it was recognized as a rather unusual resource in the park system because it was about not just a place, not just a natural resource. There are certainly lots of historical resources commemorated in the park system, but this was about one that was really more about people than it was about a place. It was about a group of really exceptional people who came together in one place and then scattered again. And it was really unusual in the park system because a lot of those people were still alive. So there was a chance to capture their stories, capture their collective memory before it was too late. And the National Park Service made the decision to incorporate a large oral history collecting effort as part of the effort to build the Tuskegee Airmen National Historic Site. Some really, I hate to say it, but uncharacteristic foresight in a large bureaucracy like that, but one for which I am very, very grateful. And they hired me in 2000 to put together a team of historians who would then travel around the country and do nothing but interview Tuskegee Airmen, bring those interviews back to the office, we'd have them transcribed, and then together with the interviewees, this team of historians would then edit them and put them in the collection for the Tuskegee Airmen National Historic Site. We were going to use those interviews for a couple of different purposes, one of which was certainly just collecting for a collecting state. We were trying to find people who could, let me just pull up this picture real quick, and I'll come back to it in a minute. If you can see the historic building, this is Moton Field. This is the airport where the Tuskegee Airmen learned to fly at a primary flight training facility. And that is the site that is now the National Historic Site. The much larger Tuskegee Army Air Force Base, or Army Air Corps Base, about 7 miles away, is no longer there. But many of these historic buildings are still there at Moton Field. And one thing we were trying to do was trying to help out the historic architects who were going to be rehabbing those buildings. So if we could find people who worked at Moton Field, ask them questions like, you know, look at this blueprint, what did people do in this room? That sort of thing. So on the front end of the development of the historic site, we were going to be asking questions that could help out there. We wanted to create high quality audio that could be used in exhibits, and I'm really happy to say that in the first phase of exhibits that opened last summer, they have made use of the audio from our transcripts, or from our recordings rather, so that you can go in there and hear from people themselves who worked as mechanics in Hangar Number 1, which you see here off to the right, talking about the work they did there, talking about the ladies who packed the parachutes, what it took to do that, all this kind of stuff. And the second phase of development is hopefully going to make even better use of that audio. And as we were doing this, that was really the most exciting aspect of working on this project. The feeling that 20 years from now, 30 years from now, when there are no more Tuskegee Airmen for school children to listen to, they can go to this historic site and listen to them. You know, learn this history in the Tuskegee Airmen's own voices and own words. So I put together a team of five historians slash oral history interviewers, including myself. The one you see in this picture is Worth Long. Does anybody know Worth by any chance? Really remarkable guy who was a SNCC field organizer in the early 1960s. And when he got burnt out from the civil rights movement, got a fellowship to go study with Alan Lomax at the Library of Congress and became a really pioneering folklorist, and just sort of dropped into my lap. You know, here's someone, he was an Army veteran himself, a civil rights veteran himself, and an expert in the field of folkloric oral history recordings. We had one other folklorist, Bill Mansfield, one other PhD historian, and one interviewer with a PhD in African American studies. Two women, three men, two African Americans, three whites. So the group itself had a really interesting mix of characteristics and capabilities that they could bring to these interviews. And if you have questions about those in our Q&A time, I'll be happy to talk about how I think that dynamic worked to the benefit of the project. And as you can see from the little caption here, we recorded over 800 interviews in the span of 5 years going all over the country. I probably don't have to tell you that it was the chance of a lifetime to get to work on that. For a civil rights historian like myself, it was a lot of fun. We spent a lot of money on it. We had nice support from friends in Congress. Congressman John Lewis came up with a nice earmark for us 1 year that allowed us to do another 300 interviews, I think. So when you hear people dismiss earmarks, think of the Tuskegee Airmen Oral History Project and the good work that we did thanks to a congressional earmark. They're not all bad. I left that job. The project wrapped up in 2005. I went back to academia and knew that I wanted to do something with this remarkable resource. And sat down to write a book that I could use in my classes about the early history of the civil rights movement and the remarkable changes that took place in the World War II era. Wars create all kinds of social changes, and the bigger the war, the larger the social change. And I wanted to write a book that addressed that and helped my students understand that. I wanted the oral histories to be the center of that effort and to drive the entire train. But as a classically trained historian, I also, wanted documents and wanted, we talked yesterday about the preparation you have to do for an oral history interview. When you're writing a narrative history, oral history can't be a substitute for other forms of research. It can be your primary means of research, but it can't be a substitute for everything else. And so I wanted to write a book that brought in all of these sources and brought them into conversation. So what I'll do today is sort of step back and take a 20,000 foot view of what this experience was like, and then play a few clips to show you hopefully how I have brought that story to life. I want to begin by reading a couple of paper sources, stepping back from oral history, a couple of paper sources that describe the immense amount of change that took place in this one institution in the course of the war. In 1925, the Army War College commissioned a study on how African Americans had performed in World War I. It was called The Use of Negro Manpower in War, and it is justly infamous now. I'll read from it. The Negro is physically qualified for combat duty, the officers who wrote this report began. However, the Negro is profoundly superstitious. He is by nature subservient and naturally believes himself to be inferior to the white. He is jolly, trustable, lively, and docile by nature, but through real or supposed harsh or unjust treatment may become sullen and stubborn. He's very susceptible to the influence of crowd psychology. He has not the physical courage of the white. He simply cannot control himself in fear of some danger in the degree that the white can. The Negro is unmoral. He simply does not see that some things are wrong, et cetera, et cetera. And it goes on from there. That formed the basis on which all policies involving race relations in the military were made in the years leading up to World War II. I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but for all intents and purposes, by 1940, just on the edge of American involvement in the war, that is the state of the art of the policymakers thinking about the role that African Americans could play in the war effort. And when we're talking about the Army Air Corps, which is considered the premier branch of the armed services, the one that requires the most brain power, the most courage, and everything else, it's easy to understand, based on this, why there was no plan to include African Americans in the Army Air Corps. And as the NAACP and A. Philip Randolph and other institutions and individuals began pressuring the War Department, the predecessor to the Defense Department, to allow African Americans to serve their country as best they could, the War Department was pushing back on that. General Marshall, on just the eve of Pearl Harbor, had his he's the chief of staff of the War Department, the head general in the War Department, had his spokesperson respond to all of these calls from African Americans who were fighting for greater opportunities. And the response is that the armed forces would not solve, quote, a social problem that has perplexed the American people throughout the history of this nation. The army is not a sociological laboratory. Okay? That's the state of the art of the military at the beginning of World War II. At the end of World War II, after these institutions and individuals have forced blacks into the Air Corps, have forced the creation of an all-black pilot squadron, fighter squadron, and that squadron has performed well in the war, and the support personnel have performed well, a bomber group that is created in addition to that has kept things stirred up. By the end of the war, it's impossible for those same people who believed in 1940 that blacks could not be trained to fly airplanes and maintain airplanes and do everything else. It's impossible for them to maintain that fiction. And the first class of the, what did they call it, the Air Command School, which is the Air Force's version of the Army War College, includes a thesis that's written by Noel Parrish, Colonel Noel Parrish, who had been the officer in charge of Tuskegee Army Air School. The difference between the 1925 study and Parrish's 1946 study is vast. He called it the segregation of Negroes in the Army Air Forces, and he concluded with this observation. In the administration of segregated units, there is no routine. There can be no consistent segregation policy because segregation is itself inconsistent and contradictory, right? So not only can blacks be trained to do this, but they've proven that segregating them is so inefficient that it hurts the nation's defense. Okay, that is a pretty vast change in the span of 6 years. Okay, and it's that change that I've tried to document in the book, and you can use the archival sources to reconstruct the arguments that the generals were having, that the policymakers were having, but you can't use those archival sources to describe what it was like to be a part of that change, right? To be the in the group of people who were both pushing the change and at the same time riding the change. So that's what I hope I've used the oral histories to do. And I want to play just a few clips for you today to give you an idea of how the men themselves and women themselves, as you'll see, with so many of the local men called off to the war effort, local women were pulled in to work at Moton Field and Tuskegee Army Airfield. It's a pilot training program, but it's not just about pilots. There were 996 pilots who were trained as part of this effort, and there were an additional 14,000, roughly, people who worked in some sort of support capacity. And we tried to capture stories from all of them. As part of this project. So the clips I'm going to play for you, I'll give you at least just a little bit of a sense of that variety. We'll start with an interview from Lewis Lynch, who was a pilot cadet who ended up being an excellent pilot. It took him some work to learn how to do it. But as you'll see here, even the stories about pilot training aren't just about pilot training. They're about something larger. And in each of the clips I'm going to play for you, they're talking about a specific subject, but it's not hard to tease out the much larger significance that they see as they talk about this. So if the technology gods have smiled on us, away we go.
I think I applied for pilot training on the 4th of October of 1942. And I was sent off to Tuskegee in early January of 43. I was elated. That was the culmination of my aspirations. I thought, boy, this is it. I'm going to go down there and I'm going to learn how to fly, and I'm going to be a big hero, and I'm going to come back with the Distinguished Flying Cross, and the girls are all going to flock to my feet and all this. No, I was seriously. I was elated because I really had the bug. I wanted to fly, and primary was tough. I had a problem flying. I really was not a natural born pilot, and in fact, I almost spun us in on turning on the final approach. Well, I knew this was bad. I had damn near killed us. And the next day, I was scheduled for a check ride. He had me fly with a gentleman named Louis Jackson. He's the guy who taught me how to fly. He got me through the program. I reported to him the next day, and he said, "You know why you're flying with me?" And I told him, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Let's see if we can find out what you're doing wrong." That's positive to me, yeah. And that's the way it hit me. So I said, "Well, I'm not dead yet." So we took off, and we got to our altitude. And he said, "Okay, I've got you. Follow me through," which means get on the controls with him. Feel everything he does with the controls. So I did that. And this was after we'd been airborne maybe 10 minutes. One of the first things he did was roll the airplane upside down. Then he did a turn upside down. And he's pushing the stick way up in the corner. He's pushing the rudders. And I can see how you can manhandle that airplane. It's not all smooth. I mean, when you're doing these things, you're hanging on the belt, you're yawing, and you're sliding around. It's not a nice, smooth, comfortable ride. But he did this, and he said, "Now follow me through." And he said, "Look at the wings." Now, I could really look out the wing, and the airplane wasn't going to just fall out of the air. And he did these things and made me follow him through. And I could see, shit, you push the rudder all the way in. You do this with the stick. It's not comfortable, but you do it. And so he put me through this, and he made me fly the airplane. Now I know that I can throw this airplane around some, and that you really do have to, you have to be in charge. And I could see how far you have to push the stick, and you could kick this airplane around. You got to feel it, And so I turned final approach. And I know I've got it nailed. I know I'm doing it right. I can hear the wind whistling, the power's off. And they had just mowed Moton Field. Wheels are skimming on the top of this stubble. I flared out for landing. And honest to God, it's the very best landing I ever made in my life. He got out, said, "Go do it again." And he turned me loose. He was fantastic. And I never flew with him again. And I didn't have a bit of trouble from flying from that point on. He taught me.
Lynch won the Distinguished Flying Cross in World War II, so obviously he was taught well. Louis Jackson, who he mentions as his instructor there, became the president of Central State University in Wilberforce, Ohio, which points out how elite this group was. At the beginning of the war, you had to have completed at least 2 years of college to be accepted into any pilot training program. And at that point, I believe fewer than 1% of African-American men had been to college. So the we're talking about the cream of the crop here, right? The absolute elites who come together in this little place in Alabama. But Lynch's story here is obviously about learning how to fly an airplane, but even more than that, it's about the sense of camaraderie that begins to develop there and the culture of excellence that that's imparted to him. So let's continue.
The B-25 had 217 100 horsepower Pratt & Whitney engines, and when those engines were churning out on either side, you could just feel the power. It was a wonderful feeling. I was aware of discrimination, segregation on the ground, how things were there, but up in the air, in that B-25, I was free as a bird because I was in control. I decided what to do and when to do it and how to do it. But each time when I landed, that good feeling left me because I was back on the ground and back into the same old, same old. But up in the air, I was free as a bird.
Okay, I think that's pretty self-explanatory. And again, it's about something much larger than themselves. It's about overcoming. It's about proving what they can do. And again, that included not just men being given the chance to prove what they could do.
My name is Finney Aragon Boyd, and I was born in Macon County, Tuskegee, Alabama. Now, when this was during World War II, and I imagine they took most of the able men, carried them to the Army, and they were short of manpower down at the little airfield. Mm-hmm. So they announced that they would like to have as many women to come and take a test. I took a class. They had classes there. After we had those classes, then they gave us a test, and I passed the test. And I was selected one of the ones to work at Moton Field. We used to change we do what you call a checkup on the airplanes before the cadets would fly. So then We'd have to have what you call a check, 25-hour check, 50-hour check, and a 100-hour check. Then our airplanes would then, Mr. Umble, being the over the maintenance department, he'd have to come in behind us and check them to see if we had did the type of work that needed to have been done on the airplane. Then the next morning, we would have to take them out. We'd have to warm them up, take them out on the field for the cadets to fly.
Who would have to take them out?
We would. All the ladies would take them out on the field. Right. We taxi the airplanes out on the field, warm them up, take them out on the field and warm them up, and have them ready for the cadets to fly. Then I learned to fly. Surely did. Uh-huh. Got in that plane and went on to, didn't think of, didn't think about what could have happened. But then the thing happened.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. I would say it was quite an experience for the women, because this was really the first time that I have heard a woman being connected with this type of work.
Just as an aside, that was Worth Long as the interviewer in this one. And one thing that I learned from Worth, I learned so much from the people who were ostensibly working for me on this project, is that a great way to decide whether an oral history is good or not is if there's a lot of laughter in it. If you've made your narrator so comfortable that you're laughing together, that's one definition of a good oral history interview. Again, this theme of camaraderie.
I went home. First time I had a furlough, I went home in my uniform and everything. Here's this second lieutenant. And I had an older brother. He had a heart murmur and couldn't get into service. And he was crazy about me and crazy about this idea that I was a lieutenant in the Army. Mm. And he said, come on. He says, I want to take you downtown. I want to see some of them folks salute you. I said, oh, man, I don't talk about somebody saluting me. Kind of. He said, no, man. We got to go. I didn't even want to do it. I did not want to do it. I said, oh, that's just wasting my time. But he insisted, so he says, okay, we'll go down, we'll do that. We got downtown, and we run into somebody, they would salute, and I would salute, you know, and everything. I saw any black people down there, was in the military. Mm-hmm. All I would salute, he'd see somebody cross the street, make him salute. And that time of salute, he'd just fall out. Oh, well, good, how did see another, salute. Oh, he'd have a good fit. Then, what I realized later is that this meant so much to him. He was so proud of his brother, the cleanse that I had accomplished and everything, and how that was. He was really proud of it. People, anywhere at that time, anywhere we would go, seeing a black officer with wings was really, people were really up there. And when we were stationed in Garvin Field for a while, and we go into Louisville on Sunday, we'd always go to church because we want to eat. See, we know we go to church. One of them good sisters say, oh, these poor soldier boys here, come on. I want to take you home for dinner.
Yeah,
man, go home. And sometimes we went home. I remember some people we went home to, man, always got that fried chicken, had some collard greens and macaroni and cheese and stuff.
Yeah.
Ooh, I'm telling you. So we knew what the plan was. And we go into these different nightclubs and things. Mm-hmm. And people say, oh, we got this officer back there. Says, what does your party want? Don't give him no bill. It's always on the house. And the folks are really, they really would do anything they could for you. I'm so happy. They just, you know, and that was one of the things that was driving all the guys to be successful, because it meant so much to everybody, to the entire race, to be successful.
Right.
So we can't be failing. Here we are with this great big chance to do something and fail.
Uh-huh.
We had to be successful. I think it gave people, one thing, it gave people an idea that if you stay with somebody, you can be successful. And I think it raised their self-esteem a lot, too, for everybody.
Another one that I think is pretty self-explanatory, and another one of Worth's interviews. This is one of those that I heard for the first time. I edited the transcript, and I said, if I ever write a book, I'm just going to include this verbatim. But one of the drawbacks of a book is that you don't get all of that inflection. You don't get... And Oxford University Press doesn't like a lot of italicizing to, to indicate emphasis and things like that. So what you read in the book doesn't give you nearly the flavor of how it's delivered by Mr. Chappelle. He's one of the 101 officers of the 477th Bomb Group. He was a navigator bombardier who was actually arrested by the commanding officer of Freeman Field, Indiana, because they tried to use an officer's club that had been designated for whites only, a sit-in that took place in 1945. So if you think the sit-ins began in 1960, you're off by 15 years at least. Well, they happened in Reconstruction, too. And the labor movement of the 30s, but it's a really important link from early wartime activism, the Freeman Field Mutiny, to post-war civil rights organizing proper. So just one more. This is from Dr. Twiley Barker, who after the war became had a really nice, significant academic career as a political scientist and constitutional scholar.
I think this is one of the big surprise and untold story. I think that the important story is that those black kids proved to the world that we were as capable of flying an aircraft as anybody else. We were as capable of providing the necessary supportive services to make certain that missions were accomplished. We could do the same kinds of things at the level expected by the military, even though our skin color may have been different. I think that story is there to see graphically. The talent is there, and if it is allowed to reach its maximum potential, any goal can be accomplished. I think that is the lesson of this.
Now, the lesson that he draws from that is something that we take for granted, most of us, I think, in 2010. A society that works best is the one that is best open to using whatever qualities and capabilities people have, regardless of their skin color or their religion or their ethnic background or whatever. Most of us, not all of us certainly, can afford to take that for granted now. But in 1945, anyone who believed that was a pioneer and was out on the edges. So the argument that I've tried to make is that the Tuskegee Airmen were out on those edges, were freedom fighters, and were able to transform this institution, which, I read from the 1925 War College study for a reason. You could make the argument was one of the most racist, one of the institutions in the United States that was most inimical to African-American desires, and transformed it in a really remarkably short period of time, in 5 years. The Air Force didn't desegregate right after the war, didn't desegregate right away, but all of that momentum was in that direction. So that's what they were able to accomplish. And they were able to do this to an institution that had been so intransigent before the war and turned it into one of the American institutions that was the very first to desegregate. Major League Baseball had, I believe, 3 black players, Jackie Robinson, Larry Doby, and one other. When the Air Force desegregated, I think there were 2 black NFL players, but the NFL wasn't even the NFL yet. And there really were no other desegregated American institutions. So the fact that they're able to do this so early and create all of that momentum and bring so much federal power to bear really puts in place a lot of the necessary building blocks that the civil rights movement would use in later years. I believe that's my time. Thank you. I look forward to your questions.
And we will definitely get to some questions, because I know that many of us probably have some ideas that are just overwhelming us right now regarding this collection of men who, I think you're absolutely right. Their very presence in World War II completely debunked every single myth of racial inferiority that had dominated the discourse on race. And so we'll definitely get to talk about that. But let's move to some commentary from Dr. Kircher. Dr. Stephen Kircher is an associate professor of history at UW Oshkosh, where he is also the director of UWO's Black Thursday Oral History Project, which is very, very interesting. As director, Dr. Kircher conducted interviews with a number of the 94 African-American students who were expelled from UW Oshkosh after a demonstration in the chancellor's office on November 21st, 1968.
Dr. Kircher has also chronicled these events in an exhibit titled Black Thursday Remembered. So please come up and share some thoughts, and then we'll go. We'll move to our Q&A.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Troy, and members of the Wisconsin Historical Council for making this possible and the people here at UW-Milwaukee. It's a real pleasure to be here and have the opportunity to maybe introduce for the first time, for some of you, the story of the Black Thursday demonstrations up in Oshkosh. But really what I'd like to do is participate in the celebration for Todd's book, which I think is, really deserving of everyone's attention. I had the great pleasure of reading an advanced copy of Todd's book, and I thought I'd take a few minutes here to share a few observations about the book before I address the oral history project that we conducted in Oshkosh. This is really an advertisement or a book jacket blurb, very brief and very laudatory. First, I'll ratify the impression all of us surely have after hearing Todd speak about the Tuskegee Airmen, that this is indeed a vitally important addition to American history and to our understanding of the long civil rights movement. And it's a narrative that is exceptionally well told here. Todd will deserve, I think, certainly the praise that scholars and members of the reading public, and I do think this book will have a broad audience, an important thing, that these diverse audiences will give this well-researched and thoroughly engaging account. So I'm first struck with this accomplishment, and particularly the way that Todd was able to utilize more than 800 oral history interviews that he and his three colleagues conducted. As a historian who is presently engaged in a book project which relies in large part on collected oral histories, I paid very close attention to the manner in which he integrated his oral history interviews with the archival evidence he collected. He talked a little bit about this before. This is no easy feat. As a trained historian, Todd's primary obligation is to interpret the story of the Tuskegee Airmen accurately and then assess its significance within the wider context of African American history. It is for that reason that Todd relates the combat experience of Tuskegee Airmen and concludes that they performed every bit as well as members of the all-white groups in the Air Corps. For scores of African Americans, the Tuskegee Airmen have become exemplars of Black heroism and accomplishment. But much to the book's credit, the significance of the Tuskegee Airmen does not rest with their combat experience alone. Indeed, as Todd acknowledges, the combat record of the Tuskegee Airmen can tell us very little about the 1938 to 1941 lobbying campaign that opened flight training opportunities to African Americans, nothing about the creation of nearly all Black military base at Tuskegee, and the culture of achievement, which he just spoke about, nurtured there, or of the massive social change that the Airmen were part of. And I think that's one of the first important contributions of this book. The story of the combat experience is there, naturally, but it's not the only story. I think it's actually, Todd, correct me if I'm wrong, about a quarter of the story. And it is in his telling of these other equally important experiences that typically do not make it into Hollywood's rendition of the Tuskegee Airmen's story, that he harnesses the power of the oral histories he and his team collected. For Todd, these oral histories become indispensable tools that allow him to, as he says, to explore. In his note, he describes this in his very handy note on sources at the back of the book, to explore topics left out of the archival record and communicate what it was like to experience life in the Black Air Force. And the experiences remembered here are often spellbinding. Consider the story of Horace Bohannon that Todd uses to begin his book, the story of how this Black pilot dazzled spectators at Candler Field by performing a difficult aerial stunt in a new P-47N, and then experienced the enormous pride of revealing to the admirers there at the field that it was a Black man who was at the controls of this airplane. He said, quote, "I took the helmet off, took the goggles off, and raised the seat up so you could see there's an African American flying that brand new airplane." Todd worries, as all of us would worry, that oral histories don't translate well on the page. Well, I think this is an example of, you know, an interview that oral history that really does. And there are multiple others. Better yet are the oral histories that Todd uses to illustrate the battles waged by black junior officers of the 477th Medium Bombardment Group at Freeman Field on the outskirts of Seymour, Indiana. It's a great story in this book, one of my favorites. These officers refused to patronize the specially created Officers Club Number 1, caustically dubbed, I love this, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and instead attempted to gain access to the whites-only Officers Club. Following the arrests of dozens of protesting officers, 422 black officers at Freeman Field were ordered by their white superior officer, Colonel Robert Selway, to sign an order affirming Freeman Field's segregated officers' facilities. Leroy Gilead was one of the 101 officers who refused to sign. He remembers, quote, "I recall quite definitely when I was given a direct order to sign the regulation or suffer the punishment of death if I disobeyed my immediate commanding officer. I was trembling in fear, but I had the feeling that my son would at least know his father was not afraid to stand up for what he believed in." That was a turning point in my entire life, and you believe it. Equally relevant and revealing is the confession of the veteran bombardier navigator, Lieutenant Leroy Battle, who muses of his younger self, quote, "I was just young enough not to give a damn." Finally, by concentrating on the struggles African-American servicemen waged at Selfridge Field, another important part of the story outside of Detroit, Michigan, and other locations north of the Mason-Dixon line, Todd's book and the individual narratives excerpted therein further ratifies the idea that the setting for the story of America's complex, troubling history of race in the 20th century is not confined to the Deep South alone, an idea reflected in a great deal of the recent historiography and in my own investigations into the struggles waged by black college students in this state, the state of Wisconsin, during the 1960s. So a little bit about what we've done up in Oshkosh. As you heard Robert say a little bit earlier, in 1968, over 90 African-American students attending what was then called the Wisconsin State University at Oshkosh felt slighted, felt imperiled, felt discriminated against. They actually couldn't even eat in some of the restaurants in Oshkosh. And they took their concerns to the president of the university on November 21st, 1968. The whole region of Northeast Wisconsin retaliated. There were large numbers of police. The students were arrested and they were subsequently expelled. Some of them were readmitted into the university a year later, but for many, this was their only chance at college education, and their hopes ended there. So we engaged in an oral history project in 2007 with support from the Wisconsin Humanities Council, and brought really what we tried to do was get on record the voices of those students who've never been able to tell their story. Remarkably enough, in the disciplinary hearings that took place at the university, only one of the students was allowed to testify. 93 went silent. No one ever knew what they experienced. And many of these people lived for 40 years without ever telling their story. So you could imagine, for an oral history interviewer, it was a pretty remarkable experience. I'm not sure how you do this, Emma. I think, is it this one? A few very, very quick details. These are a few pictures of the students who came up to Oshkosh in November 21st, 2008, in the 40th anniversary. We had the exhibition there in a gallery space. We premiered a documentary which was entirely driven by the oral histories. There was no narrative voice there. It's an hour-long documentary. Todd has used it in one of his classes. And we really tried to showcase the feelings and the sentiments and the observations that really came through in these oral history interviews. Members of the panel answered questions afterward. And I think I'm going to start here. Just again, this is going to be very brief, but maybe a good way to link Todd's work and my work is to quote this this letter to the Chicago Defender that I found. Published in September 1961, it's an account of a serviceman who tried to, who had car trouble when he visited Oshkosh. Oshkosh is a very good fishing location, and many people, African Americans from Milwaukee, would travel north to Oshkosh to go fishing. And he ran into trouble, which is not uncommon in Oshkosh. Like many other sundown towns, it didn't allow African Americans to really stay there overnight. He had problems with his car, and he encountered these problems from the locals. He says, "I went to several hotels trying to find a place to stay, but they turned me down because I was a Negro. I finally had to sleep in my car in a park," right? So here he's communicating to fellow readers of the Chicago Defender that Oshkosh, Wisconsin, is not a hospitable location for African Americans, an observation that was made often. So Oshkosh, Wisconsin was, oddly enough, then a place that witnessed a very concentrated attempt to bring African-American students, many of them from Milwaukee, to get an education. This was about 1963, 1964. What these well-meaning gentlemen, some more well-meaning than others, had in mind was on its face really good and really helpful, but they had no clue what they were doing, no clue whatsoever. And they quickly ran into the problems. African-American students from Milwaukee, many of them who had participated in the civil rights movement here in Milwaukee, one of them, Veda Harris, pictured on the right, is engaging in a textbook turn-in demonstration at her high school. Some of them matriculated at Wisconsin State University. There she is, winning the Best Dressed Co-Ed Award in 1968. She was a civil rights pioneer, beneath the well-dressed decor. She was a very, very dedicated civil rights advocate. So you have a number of people then engaging in demonstrations and attempts to bring these facts known to the university and to the people of Oshkosh. Well, the tensions eventually reached the point where Dick Gregory came up to campus, which many people thought was an incendiary talk in October 1968. Things came to a head on that day in November 1968 when the students crowded into the president's office, gave him a list of demands, told him that they would not leave his office until he demonstrated some good faith effort to actually deal with the problems that they had encountered for so long. The president refused. The policemen were called. We have great photographs of this. We've unearthed hundreds and hundreds of great photographs. And nearly every police officer in Northeast Wisconsin came in, from Green Bay, Appleton, Oshkosh, Nina, Menasha, Fond du Lac. And they came in with their helmets and their batons. The students submitted. They were arrested. And as I discussed before, eventually were expelled from the university. This had a big impact on the university as well, and the Wisconsin State University system. There was another demonstration at Madison a couple of months later that was directly linked to the demands that the students at Oshkosh had made before. And there was, as many of you no doubt know, also demonstrations here at UW in Milwaukee at roughly the same time. Okay. Let me conclude. Another interesting thing here is that one of the early supporters of George Wallace was an Oshkosh woman who's in a retirement home here in Milwaukee. I interviewed her a couple months ago. And this is emblematic of the kind of right-wing populism and law and order politics that found a very cozy home in Wisconsin in 1968. Let me just conclude then with this story by focusing your attention on a new website gives me some pride to announce this. This is the first public announcement of a new website that we have on Black Thursday. And what we've tried to do there is really foreground the interviews and give people an opportunity to hear clips from the oral histories. The oral histories really drive this site. The site is primarily intended for students and for teachers. We got funding from the Department of Education. And hopefully they'll be able to use it. I encourage you to check it out as well. I won't take the opportunity because of time to demonstrate this now, but If you go to that website, www.blackthursday.uwash.edu, hopefully you'll learn something that you didn't know before. Thank you.